This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Gene Dwofo, and here's what's coming up.
You know, seeing that news like that, is it an hard to risk your soul? I mean that I could say risking because you have to first know how it works, how it works, or those kind of things. So to me, in particular, I'm somehow scared here. I need to know more or get more information about that.
That was an officer in charge of one of the health centers in Uganda who is refusing to get a vaccine against COVID-19. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa is testifying today at an inquiry into corruption. The commission led by Judge Raymond Zondo is probing the plunder of billions of dollars from state enterprises, a scheme that's becoming known as, quote, state capture, unquote, and one which was allegedly orchestrated by Jacob Zuma when he was president between 2009 and 2018. Ramaphosa is expected to face questions about what he, as Zuma's deputy for much of this period, knew about the massive graft. Darren Taylor reports.
Opposition parties and civil society groups say it's inconceivable that Ramaphosa, as Zuma's second in command, didn't know about all the corruption. The media was full of stories about how Zuma, seemingly led by two Indian businessmen brothers, Atul and A.J. Gupta, was appointing friends at state-owned enterprises to effectively loot them.
I worked hard between 2015 and 2017, risked my life to say that the ANC can go in the direction it's going, and I was talking as part of the veterans, and that...
Frank Chekane is a senior member of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC.
During that period, I also had one-on-one conversations with the president who was deputy president then.
Chekane delivered a 33-page document containing allegations of graft against Zuma and other top ANC officials to Ramaphosa's office. But, says chief opposition leader John Steenhuisen, the ruling party did nothing to stop the rot. In fact, it defended Zuma. Steenhuisen says Ramaphosa, whether directly or indirectly, helped Zuma steal public money by seeing to it that ANC loyalists were in charge at the government companies that were looted.
Every single one of those senior people deployed, Eskom, SAA, Denel, were all subject to going through this CADA deployment committee. So I think that the president, as the chairperson of that committee for a considerable period of time during the state capture project, I think has a lot to answer for on behalf of the party.
He wants Ramaphosa to be questioned about how those appointments were made.
We're living now with the consequences. Nearly every one of our state-owned entities is in crisis because people were chosen not on their ability to do the job, but on their loyalty to the party, but more importantly, their ability to channel public money into the hands and pockets of connected cadres and individuals within the ANC.
But Steenhuisen says the president has to be careful when testifying. He refers to one of Zuma's former appointees, Batabile Dlamini, who's also implicated in corruption, and her statement that all senior ANC members, including Ramaphosa, have skeletons to hide.
Everybody in the ANC knows each other's small and yana skeletons. And I'm no doubt that the president is aware that should he spill the beans on some of the revelations of other comrades within his party, that there will be an equal and opposite reaction.
The Commission of Inquiry was sparked by a report in late 2016 by then Public Protector Advocate Thuli Madonsela. She hopes Ramaphosa presents facts and not generalizations to Zondo. But she adds that people should bear in mind that Ramaphosa was largely sidelined during Zuma's presidency.
We have to understand that deputy presidents don't have that much power. They do whatever the number one allows them to do. But it will be up to the current president to explain what his powers were. But as members of the executive of the governing party, they would have to tell us were they aware of the allegations that were being made. And
Zondo has said the entire nation knew about these allegations. South Africans now want to know what Ramaphosa did about them. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Africa resumed its COVID-19 vaccination program today after it was suspended over reports from America and elsewhere that some people had developed a rare type of blood clots following Johnson & Johnson injections. That vaccine has been the only one available in South Africa, and experts have warned that delays in getting jabs in people's arms are putting their lives at risk. Tuso Khumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Health Minister Zweli Mkhize told the media that the South African Health Product Regulatory Authority has cleared the Johnson & Johnson vaccine as safe enough. He said research revealed that amongst close to 300,000 South Africans who have been vaccinated so far, not one developed the type of blood clot seen in 8 people in the U.S.
The clotting disorder has been identified about 1 in a million kind of people. And then for that reason, therefore itself, that the risk is much, much lower than the benefit of having to use the vaccine.
The green light, however, comes with conditions. The health department is expected to strengthen screening and monitoring of patients at risk of blood clotting. There should be a safe management plan for those who develop vaccine-induced side effects. Consent information sheet should also include a clause alerting participants that there could be a risk of blood clotting. Pregnant and lactating women will not be vaccinated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine pending further research. Experts are urging the government to speed up the rollout. Health expert Alex van den Heever says if a new violent variant hits the country or a third wave develops, the consequences could be dire.
We should be getting to a point where we vaccinated about 300,000 a day. So even to this point, we haven't registered a little more than what would be a day and a half's worth of vaccinations. So we're nowhere close to scale. We're also going to hit quite a lot of hitches in that a lot of people might not register.
Fundile Nyati from Proactive Health Solutions says, though the government could do things better, some of the causes of the slow vaccine rollout are beyond its control.
The issue of securing vaccine supplies for the country has been the biggest, you know, issue, because developed countries with more money have made sure that they are the first on the line, and they have used what we call vaccine nationalism.
Despite the delays caused by the temporary suspension, the government says it is still on course to finish vaccinating all health workers by the 15th of May and starting inoculation of over 5 million senior citizens above 60 and people with pre-existing conditions. So far, over 1.5 million people have been infected with the coronavirus, with more than 53,000 deaths. Tuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Southern African Development Community has postponed tomorrow's meeting on Mozambique's troubled Cabo Delgado region after Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi went into COVID-19 quarantine yesterday. Masisi's office issued a statement on the delay. He's chairman of the SADC Group on Politics, Defense and Security, which had planned to seek a lasting solution for the oil-rich region that has been battered by deadly attacks from Islamist rebels. From Gaborone, Botswana, reporter Nkondisi Dube has the details.
Masisi had been expected to propose a military and logistical response to the security crisis, but one of his staff members tested positive for COVID-19, forcing a delay to an unspecified date. In addition, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa is scheduled to testify today before a commission investigating alleged corruption under his predecessor. Together with their Zimbabwean counterpart Emmerson Mnangagwa, Masisi and Ramaphosa have been pushing for SADC intervention to end the deadly insurgency in Cabo Delgado. In his address after the recent SADC meeting in Maputo, Masisi said the region could not stand by and watch the brutality in the oil-rich region.
The SADC state are participants and signatories to a defense pact, SADC defense pact. And the essential elements of that pact are premised on principles of reciprocity and universality and acknowledgement that an assault on one is, or an injury on one is, an injury on another. And we commit through that pact to support one another, to withstand, to repel, and eliminate any threat to our peace and security.
Mozambique President Filipe Nyusi reportedly opposes SADC intervention. A Maputo-based political commentator Adriano Nvunga warns the nature of the conflict could make it difficult for SADC to intervene.
And in terms of reluctance to have SADC intervening, I think speaks to a number of factors. One is the understanding that SADC might not necessarily have at the moment that capacity to intervene, and therefore Mozambique preferring to have a bilateral engagement with some of SADC member states, which are perceived to have some capacity, but also perhaps that might be speaking to the nature of the conflict itself, which although it is framed as an international terrorism linked to the jihadists, that might be true, but also there are important local dimensions amounting to the root causes.
A local Islamist group with links to the wider Islamic State groups has killed hundreds of people since 2017. Humanitarian agencies estimate more than 700,000 people have been displaced. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Haboroni, Botswana.
Somali President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed says he will no longer pursue a two-year extension of his presidential term, giving in to internal and international pressure. The lower house of parliament passed a controversial resolution on the extension on April 12th, but Mohamed said he will ask lawmakers to restore last year's agreement between the federal government and leaders of five federal states and the governor of Mogadishu. That agreement called for indirect elections to choose federal lawmakers who would then elect the president. The lower house invalidated that agreement on April 12th, giving the executive and legislative branches 2 more years to prepare for popular elections. The president's term expired on February 8th. The lower house action led to protests and fighting among military factions and opposition groups in Mogadishu, which sent thousands of people fleeing the capital. Many diplomats in Mogadishu, including the U.S. Embassy, had opposed the term extension. The Nigerian Senate wants a state of emergency due to heightened insecurity in the country. VOA's House of Service reports that the chamber is particularly seeking the measure for states in the country's north, where there have been a rising number of attacks by Boko Haram militants, bandits and kidnappers. In interviews with VOA Hausa, two senators said there is rising pressure on the government to hire mercenaries to help in the fight. In the past few days, more than 20 people have died in attacks by Islamist militants and criminal gangs, and this year there have been an increase in attacks and kidnappings at schools around the country. Senators described the violence as terrible and shameful, according to Punch newspaper, one of Nigeria's leading dailies. Yesterday, President Buhari did urge the United States to move the African Command headquarters to Africa instead of its current home in Germany. In a virtual meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, Buhari said the move should be made because of, quote, growing security challenges in West and Central Africa, the Gulf of Guinea, Lake Chad region, and the Sahel, unquote. Refugees and asylum seekers who have moved and started businesses outside Malawi's only refugee camp, Zalika, have obtained an injunction against being forced to return there. Earlier this month, the government gave the refugees until today to return to the camp or face eviction. It said they were threatening national security and violating government policy. The refugees are seeking a judicial review on the matter. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
High courts in Blantyre and the capital Lilongwe simultaneously issued injunctions yesterday after the refugees sought relief from the government's relocation order. The refugees argued that 14 days was too little time to move. They have asked for a year, saying some of them have a lot of property to arrange. The government rejected that idea this week. A refugee from Democratic Republic of Congo, who asked not to be named, said the action amounts to discrimination.
We have to love one another. I don't see how or why to discriminate each other. Please, please, we are all Africans. Consider our continent. We are all Africans.
Officials point to the government policy which prohibits refugees and asylum seekers from doing business outside their designated camps. Human rights lawyer Crispin Siwande says the policy contradicts the constitution.
We have a new constitution in 1994. And one of the issues that the new constitution promotes is non-discrimination. So a person cannot be discriminated in Malawi on the basis of refugee status.
He says the government should just suspend the relocation order, which he claims could incite attacks on refugees.
I'm not surprised that there's a court injunction. Refugees in Malawi have lived outside camps for over 20 years. As a result, these people have developed, they acquired property and all that. They have children, children have gone to school. They have a lot of interest, and then their rights at stake.
Dzaleka is home to more than 48,000 refugees, mainly from Rwanda, Burundi, the DRC, and Ethiopia. But statistics show that 2,000 of them are living and doing businesses outside the camp. Richard Chimwendo Banda is the Minister of Homeland Security. He told a local radio today the government is concerned about the court's injunction.
We respect the court, but that is going to impact negatively because most of them have trickled to Dzaleka now as I speak. And we had planned a peaceful transition. Police are all over the country to make sure that our brothers and sisters actually have a peaceful transition relocating back to Dzaleka.
The High Court has ordered that the judicial review be expedited and urged the government to come up with a lasting solution. Lamik Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
N'Djamena, the capital of Chad, appeared calm early today after at least five people died in clashes yesterday between protesters and the military. However, soldiers are patrolling the streets and opposition groups have called for more protests against the military council that took control of the government last week after the death of President Idris Deby. The government said five people died in yesterday's clashes, but protest groups say at least nine were killed and scores were wounded. Tensions have been high since Deby's death as he visited troops fighting rebels and a military council headed by his son, Mohamed Deby, took control of the country. Many Chadians oppose the council and seek change from Deby's three decades of hardline rule. In addition, rebel forces who oppose Deby and now oppose the transitional military council have vowed to march on towards N'Djamena. The Uganda Medical Association is considering legal action amid reports that some political leaders are threatening pay cuts for health workers who refuse to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Health workers say the threats, amid reports that 84% of them are shunning the job, violate the principle of voluntarily seeking health care. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Due to their constant interaction with patients, health workers were the first priority groups for the COVID-19 vaccine. However, statistics indicate only 24,093 of the 150,000 health workers have taken the jab nearly 7 weeks since the vaccination rollout. They say they are concerned about possible side effects. Peter Lokung, not his real name, is an officer in charge of one of the health centers in Uganda.
I just fear just because not yet very certain about that vaccine. Fear because they haven't known exactly the detail about that vaccine. You know, things aren't just new like that. Is it a hard risk yourself? I mean, that I could say risking because you have to first know how it works, how it works, or those kind of things. So to me, in particular, I'm somehow scared here. I need to know more or get more information about that.
Another health worker who spoke on condition of anonymity said her colleagues are still questioning the safety of the vaccines.
They said they first want to see after when we have immunized how we are, then they can also come and immunize themselves. And others, they said they are fearing the vaccine because of what they were seeing, the comment of people on TV commenting about the side effects that they... Other people collapse in other countries having received the vaccine, so that fear is also there.
The resistance has upset some political leaders, leading to threats to coerce health workers into taking jabs. Geoffrey Osborne Ocheng is the resident district commissioner of Uganda's Amuru district.
So if health workers do not want to vaccinate, then whom do you want to touch? So it means we are going to come up with a mechanism of seeing that they don't get salaries for like 2 months. Yes, we will hold it. They should be accountable to the life. Yes, it is going to be mandatory because you will not play with us. No, we are protecting lives.
The Ministry of Health seems to support coercion tactics. Dr. Jen Ruth Acheng is the Minister of Health.
And when resident district commissioners who oversee government programs come out to talk boldly to encourage people to get vaccinated, I must say a big thank you to them and to congratulate them, because leaders should be seen to act when people are not being responsible for their health.
However, this has rubbed some health workers the wrong way. They say compulsory vaccination violates their rights. Dr. Amon Aruho is a medical litigator.
The screening and the whatever forms for COVID vaccination are clear. You can't be vaccinated without signing that consent form, which talks about COVID and the implications of taking the vaccine itself and the after effects of the vaccine. Even if taking a vaccine would be for the best interest of your clients or patients, but still you have to consent. If you don't want to take it, you can't take it, and you can't lose your job just because you've not taken a COVID jab.
Dr. Muhereza Mukuzi, Secretary General of the Uganda Medical Association, says legal action is possible.
When push comes to shove, we can get legal redress to defend the rights of health workers.
The association has asked government to instead create more awareness on the safety of the vaccines and respond to any fears. Since the outbreak of COVID-19, over 18,000 health workers have been infected in Uganda, with 21 dying. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
For a second year, Nigerian Muslim population, the largest in West Africa, is celebrating the holy month of Ramadan under the cloud of COVID-19. Nigeria's mosques have resumed communal prayers and daily fast breaking, which were banned last year, raising concerns among health officials. Timothy Obiezu reports from the capital, Abuja.
Since Ramadan started April 13, Isa Idris joins hundreds of Muslims who observe special evening prayers at Abuja's Nasfat Mosque daily. And once the prayer has ended, they all proceed for iftar, a large meal to break the day's fasting. Idris says he struggled during Ramadan last year because of the pandemic.
As of last year, even for food in my house, sincerely speaking, God bear me witness, I found it difficult. It was my mom that helped me. But unfortunately, this year, I get food in my house, and I do my iftar here, and I also do my sahur here.
Sahur and iftar are meals to mark the beginning and end of a day's fasting. Hundreds of people at the mosque benefit from free meals through Ramadan. But feasting and communal prayers were halted last year as the coronavirus restrictions held firm. Many, like Idris, who depended on such meals, struggled to get through the fasting. Muslim clergy and head of the Nasfat Mosque, Sharafuddin Abdusalam, says they found other ways to hold prayers.
So most of our lectures last year were online lectures. And people don't come to the mosque last year to observe Taraweeh. People don't come for the 5 daily prayer.
But things are different this year. Nigeria is seeing a lower number of cases, and mosques across the country are once again holding regular meetings and prayers. But the World Health Organization and Nigeria's CDC are also warning of a possible rise of COVID-19 cases during Ramadan. Mosque Secretary Abimbola Okwala says they're taking steps to prevent that.
As you are entering the mosque, there is provision for you to wash your hand. We have a tap, about 4 or 5 tap, at the gate. So as you are entering, the first place that you go to, there is an arrow, and there are some security personnel that will ensure that you wash your hand.
Okwala says everyone entering the mosque must also wear a face mask in line with WHO recommendations. Charity banquets and other communal gatherings remain banned in many countries around the world because of an upsurge in cases. But with safety measures in place, Ramadan this year is easier for Nigerian Muslims like Isa Idris. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in. and choosing the Voice of America.